Hello, my name's Tanya Johnson. I am an advocate at Legal Aid and have worked for Legal Aid for the last 15 years. In my capacity at Legal Aid, I've done a number of sentence hearings, and it's an area of practice that I enjoy because of its storytelling aspect. The purpose of my podcast today is to give you some practical tips based on my own experience of how I approach preparation for a sentence hearing, some issues that can arise whilst appearing in court and conducting a sentence hearing, and then just going through an example that I've provided for the audience of a set of written submissions that I prepared for a matter in which I was involved in last year. So essentially, sentencing in the district court has nowadays similar qualities to a sentence matter in the local court, and I would encourage practitioners listening to this podcast to refer to the very detailed and useful materials that have been prepared in relation to the podcast concerning sentencing in the local court. The documents and the material within that podcast and that it were prepared provide some very constructive information around the preparation of a plea in terms of written instructions, and also set out frameworks which are very similar to the framework that I approach a district court sentence. So rather than repeat a lot of that content, I would encourage you to look at that in addition to listening to this podcast, because it's a very comprehensive document and it will give you a structure. I'm also going to focus on preparation where there is an agreed set of facts. Most often nowadays there is an expectation within the jurisdiction of the district court that there will be an agreed statement of facts that are resolved during the process of committal in the local court, and that allows there to be no contest or conflict around elements of the factual basis upon which the offence was committed. Generally, my advice to clients in any event is that a disputed facts hearing are best avoided, because often the consequence of that disputed facts hearing is that you lose the utilitarian value of a plea, and it erodes from that value. Well, it erodes that value and tends to detract the focus of remorse, you know, and the story behind how and why the client has committed this offence. And rather, it becomes an evidentiary process where there can be some erosion of that remorse. But that's a different topic, and that's not a topic I'm going to cover today in this podcast. But for the purposes of this podcast, it's assumed that your starting place is an agreed set of facts. The first stage of my preparation is looking at the agreed set of facts. And ideally, in the negotiation process of an agreed set of facts, you would have extracted parts of the brief that assist your client, any admissions made at the time of arrest or in the course of an interview that they participated in, any where there might be a client that has a mental illness, if they're having a psychotic episode during the course of the commission of the offence, that you would extract evidence that supports that proposition and have it within the content of the agreed statement of facts. That is because then it allows you to found a submission when you're going through the various legal principles that would apply to your matter. So it's very important that in that agreed statement of facts you incorporate material that's agreed, that then creates a platform from which you can emphasise relevant legal principles that apply to the sentencing exercise. I always create a folder of documents that include the agreed statement of facts, the criminal record, a custodial history. A lot of the material is often included in the Crown tender bundle, but I create a folder that has the core documents that are relevant. That provides the written material that I need to utilise for the purposes of creating written submissions. So the components of district court sentences from my perspective involve the preparation of written submissions, which the courts nowadays have an expectation will be provided. It doesn't mean that the art of oral advocacy has been done away with completely, but it is the case that there is an expectation now that you will file written submissions. And it is a useful exercise, in my opinion, in terms of formulating the relevant factors that you need to address on, whether it be in writing or to expand on when you're in court, if the judge wishes to hear further from you in relation to an argument that you're making. The second stage of it is considering the evidence that you will adduce. The district court, unlike the local court, although again this is changing in the local court jurisdiction, is essentially an evidence-based jurisdiction. So you can't stand there and make submissions without some form of evidence that you can point to that is the basis of that submission. And that's very important. And for clients that may not have had much exposure to the district court, they don't understand why you can't just stand there and say all those things. So it's important that you explain to the client that there is a need to have evidence, whether it be in the form of a letter, a report, records. There just has to be something that to which you can attach the submission. And that is obviously documentary evidence. The second aspect of evidence is oral evidence, so which is always a difficult area because there are risks as well as gains that can be made when giving evidence. But fundamentally, my practice is often to call my client, not only for the purpose of elevating the status of information that might be contained within a psychological or a psychiatric report to it being sworn evidence, but also just to humanise a client in the sentencing exercise, because often judges tire of hearing from us lawyers and want to hear from the person whom their decision will impact upon. It often can mean less time in custody or a community-based outcome rather than a full-time jail sentence, in my experience. And then the third and final aspect of a district court preparation is oral submission. So thinking in your mind how you're going to pitch the sentence and how you're going to interact and engage with the judge in the course of the conduct of the hearing, because again, it is what gives you the gravitas beyond what you've written in your submissions, and that's where the theatrical aspect of your skills as an advocate can influence the outcome as well. Because if you can create a rapport with the judge, that engenders, in my experience, some kind of engagement and often a respect, which means that what you say will have some validity and some influence. Because obviously, as an advocate, ultimately that's all you can do, influence. You cannot direct the judge in the exercise of their discretion. What I'm going to do now is just discuss my written submissions. And some people have different approaches. Generally, my written submissions tend not to go beyond 10 pages, 12 at the most, depending on the complexity of the issues that my client might have, but I don't do volumes of material. I don't quote at length decisions. I rather just make citations and references to paragraphs, and I tend to be succinct in my information that I've included, because I think despite the efforts of the district court to have do judges read material before coming onto the bench, the reality of the pressure, work pressures and the volume of matters that the district court deals with, it's not always something that's able to be achieved. So having somewhat comprehensive but not verbose submissions, written submissions, is the best approach. So I tend to start off with just indicating the offences, and I'm just, for reference, going through one of my previous example, the example I'm going to provide to you in the course of this podcast. And then I often, after I've indicated what the maximum penalties are and the offence, I go on to make it clear what is being asked. I think that's a very important approach because really that's what you're there for, and the judge will want to understand what it is you're asking for. And then once you've made that clear, you can then go on to explain the reasons for why. So I often, well, I always extract the Section 3, capital A of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act because I think it's a really important starting place to remind and inform the exercise of any judicial discretion. And it sets out what are often the competing considerations in sentencing. And then I like to acknowledge what I feel are the prominent themes in the exercise before the judge. So in the example that I've given where my offender is a young person, I've cited that his youth and his potential for rehabilitation mean that the principle of retribution should be given less significance because ultimately the protection of the community is facilitated by focusing on the intervention that's required to address the drug and mental health issues that underlined his offending behaviour. And I think that's just a good way to direct the judicial officer to see what your angle is in terms of the application of the themes under that section, which is ultimately the section that must be the starting point. Then, of course, there's the need to give your position in relation to the objective seriousness of the offence. And when I do that, I, with reference to the agreed facts, I set out in my document what aspects of the offence are relevant to that assessment process. And in the example I've given, I have set out perhaps 6 or 7 points that are relevant to my final submission that the offence would be within the mid-range of objective seriousness for this type of offence. The classification of objective seriousness is often an exercise in semantics. And as a defence practitioner, it's very rare that we make the concession that something is in the mid-range, let alone the high range. But it's useful to have that, the arguments for why you would classify an offence as being towards the lower end or within the mid-range, because often our opponent, the Crown, comes into the proceeding with a position of at something being at least at the mid-range. It's very rare in my experience that the Crown are prepared to make a concession of low end, especially these days. But it's beneficial, particularly if there's going to have to be some discussion in court that's not in writing about where the judge should fall, what their conclusion should be. So it's important in terms of formulating your argument to have thought that through with reference to the agreed statement of facts. Then, of course, Section 21, capital A of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act, you need to consider those relevant provisions. And again, being conscious of the legal principles that might inform whether or not certain provisions apply to the sentencing exercise, being conscious not to be duplicitous in terms of one of those aggravating features being an element of the offence. The general practice in my experience is that the Crown never address mitigating features. I guess that's because it's our duty as the defence advocate to the case, the plea in mitigation, but make sure that you address those principles or provisions. One thing to be mindful of is Section 21, capital A, 3, little I, which is that there needs to be some form of evidence. And that's a reminder that it is an evidence-based jurisdiction. So therefore, you do have to be conscious of the need to have some evidence of an acceptance of responsibility. So that can be answers that were given to a psychologist. It can be evidence that's been given in court. A bit of a stretch would be a reference where there's a, you know, the person who's written the reference indicating that there has been an expression of acceptance of responsibility or remorse to them, but that I think would lack the force that it would if it came directly from the offender or so from information that they've expressed to a psychologist or perhaps the sentence assessment report. Then the next consideration is obviously whether there are any guideline judgments that apply. In the example I've provided for this podcast, Henry has some application because the offence for which my client was being sentenced was a robbery. And I distinguished my client's set of circumstances, well, his make-up as an offender, notwithstanding the application of Henry, because, of course, it's a guideline that has application to that type of offence. I, in my written submissions, was saying that it's not binding because the assessment of any appropriate disposition is an instinctive synthesis. And that's probably a good point to really emphasise the importance of reminding the judicial officer that sentencing is an area where there's huge scope for discretion, the range, as we call it. So that range can encompass, you know, different outcomes to a degree, not hugely different, but there's that range that allows them to kind of move and figure out and be flexible and sensitive to the aspects of the offender, the offence, whilst applying with considerations of consistency, the legal principles that are relevant to the offence and that category of offending behaviour. Form 1 offences often arise, and I've addressed it in these submissions, and just as you would expect, discouraging any significant increase to the overall sentence to be imposed. In this matter, there was a victim impact statement, which obviously is an important process from the prosecution's perspective in terms of having victims heard and be seen to be participating in the process. And I think sensitively, it's an area where you tend not to kind of submit. You don't want to diminish the impact, but at the same time, you need to be mindful of whether or not it would constitute being an aggravating feature, the degree of harm. And in this situation, I said that it would not qualify. So just be alive to the impact of the statement and any sensitive, and just whether there's any kind of exaggeration within the content of the document, because whilst it's an important process for a victim to be able to assert their experience and the consequences of their experience, it's also important that it doesn't overwhelm what is reasonable in the circumstances. In this set of submissions, I address specifically remorse because there was evidence to do so, and I think it's powerful because obviously remorse has an impact on people's prospects of rehabilitation. So the more remorseful they are, the more likely they are to engage in rehabilitation because they perceive the wrongfulness of their behaviour. The AGP scheme obviously provides for guilty pleas, getting 25%, so that's fairly regulated now, and the timing of that is, of course, important. I often then go into subjective features and summarise for the purposes of the written submissions, the evidence, the documentary evidence that's provided in the proceedings, and list that. And then I kind of excerpt relevant parts of that information, providing a summary of their story using footnotes to the sources of that information, because as I've said, it's an evidence-based jurisdiction. So it's important that you're able to acknowledge the source of that information, whether it be in the course of your oral submissions or in within the context of your written submissions. And sometimes I find that quoting the reports is useful as well, because it directs the attention to the to that part of the report for the judge. And often with the pressures of time, they may not have the opportunity to fully absorb all of the information that's in the report. So it's useful to extract within your written submissions the most pertinent opinions or information that's available within that report. As is more often than not the case with legal aid clientele, mental health is a big issue for our clients, and so consideration of De La Rosa principles and how they may apply in the sentencing exercise, especially when you're dealing with offences that involve an inevitable period of full-time incarceration, it's very important to be able to establish that there's going to be an onerousness that accompanies the spending time in custody. It's also good to put to the court the submission that considerations of general deterrence should be given less weight when you're determining the sentence because of the anxiety or trauma or difficulty that will be experienced by your client in custody. Drug addiction is another theme that is often present in our clients' subjective features, and addressing that with reference to Henry, the Henry guideline, and the ways in which drug addiction is relevant to the assessment of objective seriousness is also a good thing to consider and make reference to in your written submissions. Obviously, Section 21, capital A, subsection 5, double A of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act prohibits the court from having regard to self-induced intoxication as a mitigating factor, but it nevertheless is relevant to the capacity to exercise judgment, impulsiveness, planning, and it's useful, in my opinion, to make reference to that, because clients, doesn't completely mean that their behaviour is excused, but it's relevant to assessing their capacity to exercise judgment. In this case, my client was young and this was his first time in custody. So his youth was relevant both to the conclusions of the psychiatrist in relation to his impulse control and his behaviour, which was quite serious, and what drove him to act in that way. And so the example I give referred to the case law principles around maturity, emotional maturity, and the importance of sentencing young offenders, the exercise involving more emphasis on rehabilitation rather than general deterrence and denunciation. You should always make reference to how long your client had been in custody, and where applicable, issues of concurrency, parole revocation, accumulation. These days, the general practice is not to allow for total concurrency, and that's something to be sure mindful of in terms of explaining to your client that that's unlikely, but certainly partial accumulation is more often than not the outcome. So that's something to turn your mind to as to when you think it should commence from. But in terms of advocating for there to be a greater degree of concurrency, it's important to link the issues that might have been relevant to the previous offending, for example, if they're on parole, and sort of running a theme, a line through the previous offending and this offending to justify the imposition of a sentence that has a greater overlap. And so reference to totality principles, accumulation principles, and the cases that are relevant to that is important in terms of formulating your argument and the reason for why you say the judge should sentence in that fashion. In the example I gave, I sought an intensive corrections order and set out the reasons for why it would be in the interest of the community for him to be given an intensive corrections order, being mindful of the relevant provisions of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act that dictate the considerations of where and when a court should impose an intensive corrections order in lieu of full-time custody. And then, of course, if it's an inevitable outcome of full-time custody, it's very important that you address on special circumstances, because for clients who have the issues that most of our legal aid clients do, namely drug addiction, mental health, homelessness, psychological issues, the scope for an extended period of supervision ideally would assist them in addressing those issues which underlie their criminal behaviour. So that's going through my written submissions and the relevant provisions. The next part of what I was going to talk about was evidence. Generally in that practice, I would call my client to give evidence, and I'll ask my client to adopt the content of the report. I would set out circumstances that surrounded the offending behaviour and what led up to it. I generally ask my client why this time is any different from the previous times, assuming your client has a criminal record. My approach is generally to take away the ammunition of the Crown, because you can anticipate that your Crown prosecutor or solicitor is going to deliberately seek to test, and that is what their job is, the assertions that are made by your client in the evidence that they give about their future and their commitment to their drug rehabilitation. So rather than leaving that job to the prosecutor, I often, not to the full extent of cross-examination, but ask them those kinds of questions, because I think it's useful to acknowledge that the court might be guarded as to the capacity or the dedication of your client to address those issues, given that they may have had previous opportunities to do so. I always finish up with a question around what, is there anything you'd like to say to the court? And that's generally an opportunity for the client to say sorry to the court, to the client, to the victim, to the community, and just to acknowledge the wrongfulness of their behaviour. At this stage of the proceedings, the evidence for the offender closes ordinarily. Sometimes there are witnesses that are useful to support the evidence of the offender, but it's very rare in my experience that I've called clients, family members, or other people who might be involved in their management of their case, of them out in the community, because regrettably a lot of legal aid clients don't have much support in the community. And the court can be assisted by a letter that's prepared by the relevant people in their lives. So that leads me into the third part of my preparation or my participation in a sentence proceeding in the district court, which is the oral submissions. And the extent to which I need to address a judge varies depending on the judge whom I'm appearing in front of and what their expectations are and whether we're in agreement, whether they've been persuaded by my submissions in writing. I mean, if a judge says, well, Ms. Johnson, I'm going to do this, I'll just say, well, Your Honour, I don't wish to be heard any further. Or I might just say something that, you know, confirms that we're on the same page, acknowledging that I think that's the right outcome and referring to the evidence that's been adduced. I think it's very important to just add something, because there is a live element to the experience in court, particularly when your client's given evidence, where there's something else to be added that's not within the written submissions. I'll often make a reference to the quality, you know, to the candor of my client or the sincerity of the evidence from my client. And I think that's, it's important to just to attach some weight to the process of the sentence hearing at that point of closing your case, not just the evidence but the submissions, because it that's really the advocacy, and that's where, again, there's a quality of human interaction and connection which is important in the process. Just looking over my notes, there's some parts of this that I've not addressed, which are obviously relevant, and there's, I'm not going to go into the detail of them because there are the benefit of so much material out there. Obviously, a really important consideration for legal aid clientele is bug me, because of the social disadvantage that most of our clientele come from, the deprivation, and it's important to have evidence of that deprivation or the experience of trauma in their formative years. And there's the Bug Me book, which is available through the Public Defenders, which has extensive materials and journal articles about how to properly substantiate a submission in relation to Bug Me. But it's worth doing because it goes to moral culpability, which is is interwoven into the assessment of objective seriousness. So it's very important to be mindful of Bug Me and how it might apply to the matter and your client's background. Similarly, the same with mental health. Again, it goes to moral culpability, which in turn impacts on the, impact significantly on the determination of the objective seriousness. So those are two areas that I would strongly encourage you to explore in the preparation of a district court sentence if it is that they're relevant to your matter. Other issues, of course, are assistance to authorities, section 23 of the Crime Sentencing Procedure Act. But again, I won't go into that in any depth other than to make reference to it being a possible consideration depending on the circumstances of your matter. So in terms of other materials that I would strongly encourage you to make reference to, there's the Public Defender's website for the purposes of the Bug Me book, but also other papers. I would also refer you, in addition to what material has been provided by Legal Aid in relation to the local court practice, a paper that has been provided by another advocate from Legal Aid, that is Derek Buchanan, and it's available on the CPD website. That's Mark Dennis's website. I'll include a reference to that in the. I'll set out some links in relation to that, but I think it's very important to utilise all of these materials in addition to this conversation that I've just had in the course of preparing for a district court sentence practice. And, of course, the bench book. It's a starting place because, obviously, those are the principles that are going to inform the judge in the exercise of his or her judicial discretion. So it's very important that you make reference to that to ensure that you've identified the relevant legal principles that apply to the offence or to the area of the sentencing exercise. So if you have any questions after listening to this, I'm always happy to chat and help fellow members of the profession just get in touch. So in addition to the material that I have set out in this podcast, I would encourage you to access the following resources which will assist you in your sentencing practice. First and foremost being the Sentencing Bench Book, which is available through the Judicial Commission website. It's a reference point for judges and all practitioners, and it also will refer you to relevant case law that will inform submissions that you wish to make and your understanding of how those principles apply to your matter. Then, of course, there's Sentencing Law New South Wales, which is available through Lexis Advance, as well as the Criminal Practice and Procedure site that's available through the same website. A lot of papers under the sentencing heading on Mark Dennis's criminal CPD website are useful, and I encourage you to refer to those. And they include the sentencing checklist, which is an invaluable resource that's prepared by Judge Yehia. It sets out all of the relevant principles of law and also the history of the evolution of those principles of law, and is very comprehensive, in excess of 100 pages. So it identifies the legal principles in a far more academic way than what I have for the purposes of this podcast, but it will help to found your arguments. So I strongly encourage that being a reference. Other papers include one that was prepared for quite a few years ago now in the sort of rise of the standard non-parole period. There's a paper by Eric Wilson, another public defender, and then some more papers involving district court practical considerations, one being prepared by John Stratton, and then a negotiation paper, which is important for the sort of foundation of the sentencing exercise. As I said, at the agreed statement of facts, that's a process that is undertaken through the negotiation process. And all of those papers will assist you in identifying and understanding the legal provisions and principles that apply to the sentencing exercise. And of course, the Public Defender's website for the Bugmy book. Thank you.